Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. You're finally getting a little frost. I think that's a good thing. Not everybody did, I understand. But it got down to, looking at the weather, it's 29 certainly at the airport, out in West Mobile. It probably, or lower actually, I think it's probably 29 at the airport in downtown, in Midtown. And may have gotten a little colder out in West Mobile. The temperature is rising fast with the sun. It'll be a nice day to be outside. Winter days can be like that sometimes on the Gulf Coast. Some of the nicest days to be playing around in the yard. But these cold temperatures will help. They're probably not enough yet. We hope we get some more. I think there's some more coming. This is one of those La Nina years. La Nina. When it's a weather phenomenon. And it's kind of the opposite of El Nino, La Nina. And what happens when we get a La Nina, typically, is it will be warmer along the Gulf Coast. We'll also get droughts. And many of you are in the first stage. You won't notice it yet. Won't be a big deal yet because it's winter, and plants don't need as much water during winter. But we're in the first stages of drought. Just the very first, just tipping over. So we'll watch that closely as spring comes on. La Nina droughts in spring can be a big deal, and sometimes they can last even into summer. It's bizarre. It's rare. Usually summer is our after everything else, summer is our rainfall relief. That is the opposite of the way things work in most parts of the world. But along the Gulf Coast it can be. In the upstate, things are still pretty moist, but we're going to have to watch a little bit more carefully. As La Nina continues, we may get into a drought situation throughout the state. That's something to watch. Some parts are getting enough cold. I think Mobile could still use a little bit more. I got a report from Grand Bay here from Gary. He said the frost on the kale this morning down at Grand Bay. Usually a little colder than most places down at Grand Bay for whatever reason. The cold air kind of slopes down that direction. But a little bit of cold there, that's probably a good thing. Kale will do just fine. It'll sweeten that kale up nicely. Get rid of the aphids, maybe? Huh? That'd be nice, too. You know, we're going to talk a little bit about getting things started, because it's the time of year we need to start talking about summer. If we get a chance this morning, I'm going to tell you how I start seeds, because we talked last week about some of the seeds you need to be getting. You can call me. We can talk more about that today. Tomatoes, peppers, nasturtiums. We got lots of things we need to get started right now. Get your peas in the ground. Go ahead and do it. It's time. If you're in South Alabama, if you're in North Alabama, you can wait just a little bit longer. But all of us need to be understanding how to be starting seeds right now. So we're going to talk a little bit about that as we get on this morning. But it doesn't seem like I can avoid talking about something. We'll talk a little bit more about it today. Coyotes! Coyotes. You know, I didn't wake up this morning thinking, we're going to talk about coyotes. But, you know, I hear that there's a bit of a concern going on about coyotes in Mobile. People just woke up to it in a funny sort of way. And I thought, you know, it's kind of a good little lesson in where we are. So I understand that someone over near the botanical gardens had lost a cat to a coyote, they believe. And probably it could have happened. Can also happen with dogs. Packs of dogs are a big deal. Coyotes are out there too. You know, I in Midtown, I've seen coyotes all over the place. I've seen them for decades. Literally decades, almost, it was 15 years ago, 15 years ago, I remember a coyote picking up a cat on the street and carrying it off in the middle of the night. That cat screaming. I went outside to see what the howling was about. Yeah, they're out there. You know, Charlie said to me, you know, people going to wake up and what happens when they wake up and find the coyotes are outside their windows? And I wanted to say, well, Charlie, they already are. They're waiting. They're just waiting. They're everywhere. They're everywhere. They've been here for a long time. Why do we have so many coyotes? And I'm gonna. This is something we really need to understand. And it's true for many of the things that we consider pests, and we never stop to consider why. Why? Why do we have so many coyotes? We have so many coyotes for the same reason we have so many rats. For the same reason we have so many cats running around the streets. For the same reason we got raccoons coming up on our porches and stealing dog foods. We got coyotes because coyotes think we love them. They think, boy, these folks, these human folks, man, they must love coyotes because they are just putting out a meal for us all the time. They are just creating an environment that's perfect for us. Let's get next to these people. We love these people. They are so good to us. And that is why we have coyotes. There's a lot of talk now about, well, let's trap the coyotes. Let's get rid of the coyotes. Let's put a bounty on the coyotes. There have been states that have had bounties on coyotes for half a century. Probably longer. 50 years or more. Has it had, what impact has it had on the coyote population? Zero. None. There are 500,000 coyotes killed every year in the U.S. as a result of bounties or whatever else. 500,000 coyotes killed every year. It's having zero impact on the population. None. None at all. If you wanted to affect the coyote population in Alabama briefly, for a year or two, I would estimate if you killed about 100,000 coyotes each year, you might have some impact. We ain't even close. And with places with bounties, they don't kill that many. They don't kill that many. It's because coyotes reproduce very rapidly. And the more they're stressed, the faster they reproduce. The only thing that will limit reproduction of coyotes is to eliminate the food source, is to eliminate the things that attract the coyotes to people. Eliminate the way humans are changing the world that makes it suitable and lovely for coyotes. And suburbs are perfect for doing that. Leaving cats outside at night is not good for cats in any situation. If you really love your cats, don't put them outside at night. It's got to cause all sorts of problems for wildlife, but it also is just putting your cat in danger. It's not going to help to trap the coyotes. If you trap the coyotes, it'll be dogs that'll kill the cats. If you're feeding raccoons, I can guarantee you there are coyotes nearby. The raccoons are probably more of a danger to you, quite honestly, than the coyotes are. They are probably more likely to carry rabies, more likely to attack humans than the coyotes are. But be thinking about you. If you want to know why we have so many coyotes, it's you. It's us. It's the way we change the world. We can think about that. It's important to think about that in the garden. That's why I bring it up. It's important to think about that with most of our great pests. With rats or with raccoons, whatever pests we manage to create, possums, they follow us around because we create a world that makes it really easy for them. The animals that don't like being around humans, they're now rare. It's a funny thing. We are creating a world full of pests. Something to think about. Something to think about. Hey, let's talk about other things. When we get back, and figure out how to make your garden a really great place this spring.
I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard. The living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family. I am a country girl. I've been around the world. And every place I've been, ain't quite nothing like.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
The rain is falling through the mist of sorrow that surrounded me.
Hey, let's get back to this. We want to talk about plants this morning, but I knew this would set off a little storm, and that's a good thing. It's a good time to talk about coyotes. They're now very much around us. They're everywhere. They are increasingly. A lot of people see them as a problem, and with our normal human instinct to sort of not be able to identify what the real problem is, we have decided that we are we can somehow kill and eliminate all the coyotes. Ooh, you remember we tried that with fire ants? How'd that work out? Because we didn't figure out, you know, there's a reason. There's a reason these guys are here. We still haven't figured out that we create the ideal habitat for fire ants. In many natural areas, there is still a lot of resistance to fire ant invasion. We create the ideal environment. And for that reason, I don't think we'll ever be shed of fire ants entirely, because we'd have to accept other ants in their place. And we haven't figured out how to do that yet. But we will have coyotes for a long, long time. I think, you know, somebody's going to say, and I'll hear it soon, I got a gun. So guns, crossbows, they've been moderately effective over time in reducing the human population. Not hugely successful, but successful enough. They've been good enough at reducing the human population that it's probably something we ought to think about and worry about. They really aren't very successful. They haven't been very successful at reducing the coyote population for a lot of reasons, because of the way coyotes breed, but mostly because we create so much beneficial habitat for coyotes that it would complete, even if we were good hunters, and we're not. We're really sorry at hunting. Sorry, guys. We are. We don't call a lot of deer. We're not really successful at hunting. We don't kill a lot of creatures anymore by hunting. But even if we did, we're creating such an incredible habitat that the coyotes will persist, and so will a lot of other creatures. Got some callers. We got lots more to talk about. Gary, I'm listening. What's up?
It is a beautiful morning. On the way to the hunting camp because the deer are rutting, and it's a good time to be in the woods. Just comment on the things. In the last, I'm almost 70, and in my lifetime, we have had an invasion of fire ants, armadillos, coyotes, and feral hogs. We take 100 of hogs a year off our land, or so. We don't even dent them. But you made a good point. We all remember when there was tons of nutria. that was an invasive species. Well, there's very few nutrients anymore. And the reason why, because we've had a proliferation in our gator population and at the expense of nutrients. So you're right, the food source. And another thing is turkey buzzards. There's a lot more buzzards than there used to be because there's a lot more roadkill and other opportunities for them to have food. And but on the coyote front, one thing is everybody used to hunt rabbits when I was a boy, and almost nobody hunts rabbits anymore, and that's one of the primary food sources of coyotes, plus the increase in feral cats, as you mentioned. Coyotes love that, you know, they can catch and kill those kind of animals. Anyway, just wanted to throw my 2 cents in on those items.
Yeah, Gary, thanks. That's a good testimony. And, you know, it is interesting. I can kind of remember the first time I saw each one of those creatures you mentioned. Fire ants, of course, happening well before I came along, but it happened at the Port of Mobile. Ed Wilson was there. E.O. Wilson was there and first identified those fire ants in Mobile, became a very famous scientist later on. But I remember when the armadillos crossed over into Mississippi, and people in the Mississippi Delta were talking about them when I went to hunting camp in the Mississippi Delta as a kid. And they said, you know, there's this new creature. And then a couple of years later, they started talking about, you know, there's this thing. It kind of looks like a wolf. They call them coyotes. And we kind of watched it all happen in my lifetime, as in your lifetime. All of these things moving in. And they move in for a reason. They move in for a reason. I think the big gap in the coyotes was that we eliminated the red wolf. And it was really important in the Southeast and sort of keeping the coyotes out. One of the interesting things about red wolf, it was smaller than the gray wolf a little bit, bigger than a coyote, but it really hated to be around people. It just didn't like being around people. It was really a wild animal. And it didn't hunt, it didn't hunt in the typical way of gray wolves, didn't hunt quite like coyotes either. But we shot them out, and when we did, we got this thing that came in that just really loves people, that loves being around people, that loves the way people disturb the environment, and that's what we got. I think I'd rather have the red wolf. But you still there, Gary?
Yeah, I am, yeah. I've heard people talk about the red wolves, and I never saw one. I guess they were extinct before I started my hunting life, but I have heard people talk about them, and I have wondered, assuming that they were killed out by humans.
Yeah, yeah. But, apparently they would. They did. They didn't. Red wolves didn't breed as well as coyotes did. Was one of the things, and they didn't adapt to humans as well as coyotes did. So it was easier to wipe those populations out, apparently, than it was to wipe out coyotes. So that's an interesting thing.
We kill a few coyotes every year, but I tell you, they live up to their moniker, Wiley, because they can be trotting through the woods, and they can be upwind of you, and you can be 20 feet up in a tree stand, and they can still radar you. I don't know how they do it, but they are really keen.
Yeah, yeah. So here's the funny thing. I ride my bike all the time, or used to do it a whole lot more in various cities in Birmingham, when I was doing work in Birmingham, in Mobile. And the interesting thing was I'd see coyotes all the time. And I don't know what it is about a bike that they sort of ignored bicycles. They wouldn't ignore walking people. But you'd be going through a suburb. I mean, I'd be going through this really nice suburb with these big expensive houses, and a coyote just kind of loped down the driveway and go into the backyard and hide in the bushes. It was amazing how many times I'd see them.
Thank you.
But they're out there. All right, Gary. Hey, have fun at hunting camp. Good. So we've got another caller here. Bill, I'm listening. What's up? Was that Bill bleeping at us, or is Bill still around?
Yes, I'm back now. Something happened to my cell phone. It went kind of crazy.
I don't know.
All right.
But I've been watching, listening to your show for quite some time, and so I'm going to try something you recommended. I believe you recommended the Santiago tomato plant or seed and the Mexican midget seed. So they were hard to find, but I found them. I should have those seeds in a day or two.
Yeah.
Now what do I do?
That's a great question, and I'm so glad you asked it, because it's perfect time to talk about it. We're probably not going to have time to talk about it entirely before the break, but the first thing you need to do is get something to put those seeds in, and I recommend a smaller seed pack if you can. And there's a thousand different ways to do it. If you can order on the internet, they'll make short little seed packs. You don't need them to be real tall, and get them started in a small seed pack, and put them someplace where it gets warm. I'm going to tell you, here's one of the ways I did this inside. I did it inside. I wanted, and my wife bought me this, and it was the perfect thing. They make those little plastic storage things that you can put under your bed so that you can put clothes in them, and they have a clear top. I put all my seeds in there, kept them a little bit warmer, kept them warmer than the rest of the house. I put a little I have a little heater that I put under there. That's a little flat sheet that doesn't cost much, but you can get them for like $25. You just put them under there, you plug it in, put it in that little plastic thing. After you've put your soil in your seed pack and planted your seed, and they'll germinate incredibly fast. So that's the basic story, but we got to take a break, and I'm going to come back, and if you'll hold on, Bill, let's talk about this in detail.
Thank you.
Down south, how the weather in the Delta, how the food tastes in your mouth. For the beans and cornbread, grits and greens, candy yam and black eyed peas. If you're going to Mississippi, where that Delta sky is sweet and clear. Ooh, y'all, I'm stuck here.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back, Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Bill, are you still there?
Yes, sir, I am.
All right, good, good. So, Bill, you know, Bill said, he told me this morning, folks, he said, you know, I took your advice. I got some tomato seeds, Santiago, and this Mexico midget. He said, I went to a lot of trouble. I want you to know.
I did.
Is that right? You had to find them. But he found them. And so now the next question is, and it is the question of the hour. It is the question of the hour. What do I do now?
Exactly.
How do I get them started? So it's the time to do it. Bill, let's start again, and let's take a little bit of time. What we need is we need some warmth. We need, you know, rooms are a little cold. If your house is 76 degrees, oh, I hope it isn't. That ain't healthy.
It's not.
Yeah, so if it's 76 degrees, you probably don't need any extra heat. But assuming your house is around 68, 70 degrees, you probably could use a little bit of extra heat, to get those seeds started. You need a seed container. You need something to put the seeds in, and there's a lot of things out there. I think the simplest thing to do, and you may find your own method later on, but the simplest thing to do, Bill, is to get one of those little plastic six packs, And you can buy them, I think you can buy them even at the big box stores, but you can certainly buy them at places like, A Bloom or Old Time Seed and Feed at the local seed places. You can also get them on the internet. But just a little six pack, it doesn't have to be a big one. It just a normal size six pack, that you fill with soil. Get some good soil you're going to end up getting Miracle-Gro because it's basically what's out there now. There ain't nothing special about it. It's just that's the kind of thing we're stuck buying nowadays because it's all anybody sells. And you'll get it and just fill that up. And you want potting soil. You don't want gardening soil. You want potting soil because you're growing it in pots. Fill your little seed packs up. Put your seeds let me go back. Don't fill it up. Fill it up about halfway. About halfway. Push your soil down about halfway, and then put your seeds on. Put your seeds on top of the surface, and just sprinkle a little bit of soil across the top. Not much. Put two or three seeds in each little compartment. Drizzle a little bit of soil on the top, just enough to cover the seeds. Moisten it a little bit. And then put it in a nice warm place. It doesn't have to be hot, and you don't want to put it where it's going to get burned by the sun, but just a nice warm place until those seeds germinate, which, depending on if you can keep a steady warmth of around 75 degrees, they'll germinate in 3 or 4 days. Boom. And wow. Then you want to put them in a windowsill. And that's the simple part of it. As the seedlings grow, add soil. As the seedlings grow and they develop their second set of leaves, add soil so that it will continue to develop roots as it grows up. I find that this is helpful in several different ways. It actually tends to reduce, in my experience, it dramatically reduces damping off, which is a problem that can occur with young seedlings if the crown stays too moist. This actually tends to decrease damping off. The other thing, Bill, I'll tell you, is water from the bottom when you can. And what that means is you get a tray of water. It could be a aluminum pan, whatever, some like an aluminum roasting pan. It could be anything. Put the water in it and let it soak up that water from the bottom. That means the plant will be better watered, and it reduces the chance that you'll get damping off. So those are the basics. Does that all make sense?
I bought those little biodegradable pots, so I could set those in that pan, and they'll soak the water up like a sponge from the bottom?
They will. And the biodegradable pots are just fine. I do find that they don't transfer heat quite as well, but they're fine. They'll work just fine. It can help, particularly with those biodegradable pots, if you water them with warm water. That will help a little bit. So put some, you might even heat up a little bit in a kettle and make sure that you don't want it boiling, but you want it pretty warm. And let it soak up that warm water from the bottom, particularly initially when you're trying to get the seeds to germinate. Later on, it doesn't matter as much. The biodegradable pots are fine. You may find that they break down too quickly on you. We'll see. And next year, you may adjust. But that's fine. That's a good way to start. I know a lot of people who start with biodegradable pots, and they do just fine. I prefer the plastic ones for several reasons. There's also another thing that I use. It's cloth bags. They make these little woven cloth bags that are actually really good, and I find they hold up a little better than say the peat pots, and they also transfer heat really well. So I can put a heater underneath, what we call a soil mat heater or a seed germination mat underneath. That has gentle heat that comes up. And it's absorbed well, and you can buy one of those if you like. Don't get an expensive one; just get a regular old one, and with a UL rating, of course, because you don't want to shock yourself. But And then put it underneath those seedlings, and that works too.
Well, I bought those pots, bought some plastic and some biodegradable. It Lowe's this morning. I didn't buy any potting soil because I wasn't sure exactly what I needed to use. I was going to wait till I talk to you about that first.
Yeah, you know, I could identify a perfect seed mix, but you wouldn't have you'd have a really hard time finding it. So we go with what we got.
Tomato seeds too.
Yeah, that's right. So I'm not going to try to get you started on a perfect mix. I'm going to say that the stuff they sell at the getting stores is good enough. Just make sure it's potting soil. Make sure it's potting soil. They'll tell you all kinds of things like this will feed plants for 6 months. Well, you don't need something that feeds plants for 6 months. In fact, you really don't want any fertilizer at all, but they'll all have fertilizer in them, and you're kind of stuck with that. Just get a regular one. If it'll probably say they'll probably have one that feeds for 3 months. That's fine. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about the moisture control. They'll have some expensive moisture control potting soil. Don't do that. It's going to rot your seeds. You just want regular potting soil, and with as small an amount of fertilizer as you can find, as little fertilizer as you can find in a potting mix. That's what you want.
Got it. I'll go back and get that now because my seeds will be showing up any day. I want to have everything ready as soon as they get here.
That's right. That's right. Well, it sounds good. And then, of course, once those leaves develop, you got to make sure they get plenty of sunlight. Find a place on the south side, a window that faces south, because that's going to get the most sunlight if you can. Have you got a spot identified for that?
I do.
Good. And you know, the other thing I tell people, it's going to stay too cold for the next week or so. It's going to warm up probably around the 1st of February, and your seedlings are going to be pretty good by then. If we get 55 degree days, if it's 55 degrees outside and the sun's nice and it's not too breezy, take your seeds outside and put them on the porch during the day. It will make a ton of difference. It will make a ton of difference. And then bring them in at night. It's just good to do, and it's kind of like letting the dog out and then bringing the dog back in at night. It's all fine, and they're much happier for it.
Gotcha. Well, that's very, very good advice. I would have never thought about watering from the bottom. And I'm going to get one of those plastic containers like we do for storage clothes and things in. And I got a man cave downstairs that I can – close off about a small portion, about a 4x8 portion of it. I can close off. I think I get one of them electric heaters and put in there.
Sure. Now don't get it too hot, and don't burn your house down. So do it right. That's right. And that's all good.
One more thing I want to thank you for letting us know on the radio show was the composting. You know, I felt like most people have, I bought one of those expensive black lifetime warranty tumblers. You could put it in and tumble it. That was a joke. So I remember you said, why would you put the compost product anywhere but in the garden?
That's like, right.
Well, that makes sense. So now I've been putting that compost in my garden, just in the garden itself, just scattered at random. You said don't worry about that scientific formula of so much green and so much brown. That was good advice.
Right.
My ground is so rich. The joke around me is when I put that rebar in the ground for support, they come over there and go crap.
That's right.
All right. Well, good advice. Great, great, great show. Great show.
Bill, thank you.
Thank you so much.
On your bending knees, I ain't going to dig no more taters. I decline, I ain't going to pick no peas. Because everything is on the phone, you know you got to go. I get down on your bending knees.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window,
Ugh. That's always a good sign for the next segment, though. All right, let's turn it down. So we got a short segment coming up. We got a lot of questions to answer. Raised this morning. I want to talk about potting soil briefly. We'll talk about it as long as you want to talk about potting soil. If you want to talk about potting soil in this next hour, let's talk about it. So Sean asked me, what is my opinion of Fox Farm Ocean Forest potting soil? Well, to be honest, I've never tried Fox Farm Ocean Forest potting soil. When I read the ingredients, I think, you know, I don't want to use this. And here's why. Here's why. It's very simple. With potting soil, you don't want a bunch of gunk in it. You don't want a bunch of fertilizer. You don't want a bunch of bat guano. You don't want it to be sticky. You don't want it to hold together. You want it to be open. To me, the ideal potting soil, listen to me, and it's hard to find this, but it's you can get it down at Shore Acres. Shore Acres has it. For small seedlings, I don't think you need to go get a big bag of Shore Acres potting soil. But listen, here is the ideal potting soil. I didn't make this up. I learned it from nursery growers, and I figured out what our problems are and how we got to deal with them. You want it to be about 75% pine bark. Now, I want you to think about that. The pine bark's about the size of your fingernail, but it's not sticky. It drains really well, and that's one of the things you really need to have with potting soil, is something that drains well, that holds on to moisture just a little bit, but that allows that moisture to drain through. Otherwise, you're going to get a sticky mess. You're going to get all kinds of diseases. So particularly for starting seeds, let me say, don't go for I don't care whether it says organic. I don't care whether it says made in some science lab. I don't care if it says we'll take care of your plants for 12 months. None of that matters. What matters? Only one thing matters, really, and that is that the potting mix has to be well drained. You don't want it to hold on to moisture for a long period of time, particularly at the surface. You want it to go ahead and dry out at the surface. Pine bark is really good at doing that. Pine bark is also antiseptic. There is a degree to which this has been measured, that it tends to discourage some of the diseases that can occur in a potting environment for various reasons. And they can damping off is a big problem. So I think that's really good. So there it is. There it is. That's the standard you're looking for. There are a lot of expensive potting soils out there. They got all kind of pretty labels. They got all kind of pretty names. But I'm just going to be blunt. All you really want is about 75% pine bark. The rest can be, it wouldn't even hurt to have a little perlite mixed in on top of that, say 5, 10% perlite and 10 to 15% sphagnum moss. That might be a really good mix for a lot of purposes, including starting seeds. But, you know, the 75% pine bark is the important part. Anything else can get too sticky. It can get too wet. It can be too moisture retentive. Does that help? Sean, does that help? Just give me a nod if it does. That's just the thing. And there's a lot of funky things out there. So we've been talking about Cody's. David, I shouldn't even admit that David Hubble would say anything like this. David says, so that means to control the coyotes, we got to control the roadrunner population. Of course, roadrunners have, as we all know, do a good job of controlling coyotes. But, yeah, well, I'm sort of saying that, except we don't have roadrunners here that much. There's evidence that they may exist in the Black Belt, that they've kind of, I don't know whether they're native to Alabama, but we think we see roadrunners now and then again in Alabama. But yeah, that's the thing. But there it is. We have to think about how did we contribute to having the coyote population? And we meaning people collectively, but sometimes it's people individually. What are you doing around your house that's actually encouraging coyotes? If you don't want coyotes there, I guarantee you, leaving cats out at night, leaving cats out during the day even, is a great way to encourage coyotes. It just, and you're not going to, you're not going to have a gun. It's not going to stop a coyotes. You might kill one coyote and get arrested for it in the city of Mobile. But that ain't going to stop the coyotes. Neither are crossbows. Doesn't matter whether they're legal or not. That's not going to stop a coyote. Getting a trap for $375, for $5, for $1,000, none of that's going to matter to the coyotes. What's going to matter is the food source. And if you have a food source, garbage that's available, raccoons that are abundant, cats everywhere, you're going to have coyotes. It's just that simple. You may not see them, but they're there. They're right outside your window, as Charlie says. And I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you could jump up and down and storm all around and pull out your guns and shoot the ceiling, do whatever you want. It ain't going to change the fact that as long as the food source is there, you're going to have coyotes. I guarantee it. I promise. I promise. That's just the thing to think about. It's a good thing. And why am I going on about coyotes? Well, because it's a subject of the day, but also it's because so many of the problems we have in our gardens and around our houses and living in the world is about the world, is about how we make the problem. We are the source of the problem. So sometimes it pays to look at ourselves and say, how did I do this? It's a great way to start with it's one of the best ways I know to start solving problems. I'm not saying it's always our fault individually, but oftentimes it is. Thing about another question, Jim asked about hogs eating coyotes. Well, not really. No, hogs don't eat coyotes. Coyotes will eat wild hogs, not probably enough to have an effect on the population. They may move them around a little bit, which may reduce the population a little bit just simply by reducing reproduction. But I think, Jim, yes, it was donkeys. Donkeys will, and llamas don't really like canids, and they will kick, they may even kill coyotes in a certain situation. I don't think they'll have a lot of effect on the coyote population, however. But yes, they do. Certain equids, certain horse-like things and llamas, which are camels, they don't like dogs. They don't like coyotes. There it is. We'll be back. We're going to talk about other things in this next hour. You give us a call, 251-343-0106.
My girl, don't lie to me.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, look at this. We're back. Yeah, it's kind of been a fun discussion this morning. I hope I haven't irritated anybody. I don't mean to exactly. not really. I only irritate us when, sometimes I'll be honest, sometimes I have to get irritated before I respond to things, before I think about things hard. And if you get too irritated, you don't think about them right, do you? You kind of just don't. So I got to be careful. Got to be careful. But the thing is, we really do need to understand our relationship with things like coyotes. It's just this perfect thing. And raccoons and cats and squirrels. You got squirrels, there's a food source. You want to deal with squirrels? The most state-of-the-art thing you can think about is, what am I feeding them? What are they eating? There ain't nothing more state-of-the-art than that simple question. What am I feeding these guys? Why are they hanging out with me? Because most animals, honestly, most animals, they don't like hanging out with people. They really don't. Some animals have, and they're the animals that have become rare. It's kind of unfortunate. It's kind of unfortunate. They're the animals that would do us the least harm, that would do us the that would annoy us the least. But we've made them rare because we've decided everybody has to get along with humans. And so the things that get along with humans are the things that annoy us the most. And the reason they get along with humans is because they love our habits. And they know we don't think about how we affect them. They know that I don't know that they know this, but they just think that we are just the nicest folks in the whole world because we make life easy for them. Think about, how do you make life easy for the things you don't like? Interesting question. Interesting question. Somebody said, I found a trail this morning in my backyard, got a couple of outside cats, but I don't think cats make trails. Well, they certainly can. They certainly do. I used to hear coyotes. I guarantee you got coyotes. I would say that trail, however, is very much a small animal trail. Could be a raccoon. Could be a cat. Could be a possum. All those things are around your house. You got cats. I guarantee you got those other things too. Coyotes, possums, raccoons, cats. It's kind of a little weird ecosystem that we create. Rats are part of that too, around our houses. So, they're still there. Billy Bob there. Especially in places like Fairhope, especially in suburbs, especially in urban areas, you're going to see these kinds of creatures. They're abundant there, really abundant there. Clay is asking me about, Clay, what you had several questions. First off, I got to talk about ashes, using ashes in the garden. And it can be very useful. On the Gulf Coast, you almost can't, it's hard to overuse ashes. I don't say go crazy. Typical fireplace, you don't have a lot, you're not burning a lot of fires, particularly this winter. So you're not going to have a lot of ashes available. It's going to be hard to overdo ashes. Up around Birmingham, where you might have a few more fires and where you got more clay soil, you might have to think a little bit about it because you can get too much of a good thing. But in general, Clay, I don't think you'll end up using too many ashes. Ashes are really important. Originally, ashes were our most important source of potassium. Potassium is incredibly important to plants. And ashes are a great source for it, potassium. The other thing that ashes do, most significantly, is to change the pH of the soil. And at one time, ashes were our lime. It's what we didn't use lime. Lime wasn't available in the way we have it now. It wasn't easy to transport. It wasn't mined. And a lot of people didn't have it. So one of the things they used were ashes. And this is one of the reasons why burning was so important to gardens and other things. Ashes were incredibly important for both as liming and for potassium. So those two things are really important to understand. And Clay, I'm going to come back and talk about the tomatoes a little later on, so hold on. But those are the two most important things, potassium and raising the pH, much like you would with lime. They do not provide calcium in the quantities that you would need, though. So that's one thing that ashes don't provide that lime would provide. So you need to be thinking about that. You need to be thinking about that. I'm listening. Who's our next caller, Charlie? Darlene? Darlene, I'm listening. What's up?
Hi. Got a question for you about tomatoes. Well, I know I'm kind of late getting them started, but where is there anywhere locally here in Mobile or the Sims area to purchase tomato seeds? And if so, what kind would you recommend?
Yeah, your selection's got to be really limited, I suspect. And I have not checked A-Bloom to see what they have. You might check. But, you know, your selection is going to be really limited, probably more limited than it would be if you went and bought the plants at Home Depot. Or, excuse me for saying Home Depot out loud, but Home Depot or Lowe's or Walmart. The selection is going to be very limited. The selection of seeds locally, in my experience, is pretty limited. Now, if A-Bloom or our old time feed and seed has a big selection of tomato seeds, they ought to call me and bang me over the head. I generally recommend that for tomato seeds, you shop on the internet and they'll come pretty quickly. They'll get here within days of your ordering them. So it's a pretty good way of doing that.
Any recommendations of a company that's better to use than others?
Catalogs, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. In fact, there's a bunch of them. Totally Tomatoes is one. Tomato Grower Supply is another one. The Tomato Fest out in California is another one. I get some of my seeds from, but any of those are a good place to start. Remember what I said about tomatoes. So we got this started. We got to finish it here. So let's talk about what I said about tomatoes. Here's the thing with tomatoes. What you want is something that produces, when you look in the catalog, look for something that produces within 65 to 75 days, okay? You don't want something that takes 90 days or 100 days to produce, particularly if you're starting out, because you're not going to get them going in time. Even if you started in early January, you wouldn't get them going in time. 65 to 75 days is I like smaller tomatoes because you'll get more tomatoes and the tomatoes generally taste better. Almost always smaller tomatoes taste better than bigger tomatoes. Just a fact of life. People don't like me saying that out loud, but it's true. They do. They just taste better, and there's a lot of good reasons for that. So smaller tomatoes, you'll get more of them. You'll have less disease problems. You'll have less bug problems. And you know, what you need to do is go look for some of these catalogs, and you might even have time to call me back before the hour's out and say, I saw this in a catalog. What do you think about this tomato?
Okay.
And we'll talk about it. All right.
That's great. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. Charlie, we don't have any other calls, do we? Yeah, okay. So I'm gonna try. Michael, yeah, we got 30 seconds. Michael, I'm going to look at your question. We're going to figure that out over this break, so I'm going to sound intelligent when we come back. And, folks, give us a call, 251-343-0106. You might think we're talking about coyotes and tomatoes. We are. But we talk about lots of other things. And you could just jump in this morning, ask us whatever question you need to ask us, 251-343-0106, 251-343-0106. We still have time. We still have time to start tomatoes. Let's talk about it today. Let's get it done. You'll be okay. You'll be okay. You'll still have some good-sized tomatoes. Get them started as quickly as possible.
You can take all the tea in China, put it in a big brown bag for me, sail right round all the seven oceans, drop it straight into the deep blue sea. She's as sweet as Tupelo honey, she's an angel of the first degree. She like honey, baby.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Sugar magnolia, blossoms blooming, that's all empty, I don't care.
So my baby down by the river,
who she got to come up soon for care.
Back, boy, that was a quick take out there, wasn't it? The Grateful Dead, known for going on and on. They didn't go on and on that time. Let's get started. There's lots of great questions. Michael wants me to talk about preventing damping off, and one of the first things I want to say, Harry, hold on, because I know you got some good questions. Harry's calling in, but Michael wanted us to talk about damping off in tomatoes, and that's when your seedlings, they come up, they look so pretty, and then they just tump over. You know what I mean by tump. I mean, they just sort of keel over, right, and die. Like there's something happening at the ground soil, and it is. It's just right above the soil. It's a variety of diseases. Could actually be several, I think. Pythium and maybe even a Phytophthora and other bacterial diseases as well. All of them can cause damping off. And it's usually as a result of excess moisture at the soil level. That's a big problem. Not enough air circulation. That's why it's so. Listen, here's the things I do. Michael, oh, Harry, call us back here in just a minute. Don't leave us if you can. But Michael, here's the thing with damping off. First thing I said, you remember I said to the person that called me earlier today, I said, get you a little six pack, but don't fill it quite to the top. Fill it about half to three quarters of the way up. There are several advantages to that. But once that seed emerges and gets its second set of leaves, then start putting more soil in. I think I understand why it works. All I can tell you is it works. It reduces the chance that I'm going to get damping off. If you build the soil level up, you create new roots higher on the stem, it sort of prevents that damping off from occurring. That's one of the tricks I use on peppers and tomatoes. Now, I don't have a scientific report that tells me why that works, or that is a controlled experiment in that it works, but it has worked for me pretty consistently. So that's a really important thing. Here's another thing I do, Michael, in terms of preventing damping off. Air circulation, really important. So if you have your seedlings under black light or whatever, you know, some other fancy contraption down in the basement, they're not getting any air circulation, they are going to be more prone to damping off. If you can take them out on the porch and let them get sunshine and moved around by the breeze, get a little air circulation around the top. On those warm days, don't do it on a day when the temperature is below 55. But if you get in the temperature is 55 and above, put them out on the porch. It makes a ton of difference. A few days like that, you can pretty well eliminate damping off. It can make a ton of difference. That's air circulation, and it's sunlight, and it just seems to discourage all of those things that cause damping off. Here's a third thing you can do, and it's harder because I can't find it anymore. But if you use a very coarse material as you're building up the plant, as you're building up around the plant, if you use something like pigeon grit is one of the things that's recommended. It's really hard to find the right pigeon grit anymore, so I'm not going to say it. Forget that I said it. It'd have to be pure granite. Shouldn't have anything else in it. It should be pure granite. I can't find it anymore. I don't even know where you get it. If you can find really, really coarse sand, and I mean it's got to be coarse. It can't be river sand. It can't be beach sand for a lot of reasons. It's got to be coarse sand. If you can find really coarse sand, that works as the top layer. And that tends to reduce damping off, but it's got to be really, really coarse. So having that top layer be a different material that doesn't absorb moisture quite as well can be a big difference. The trouble is finding it. I can't find it anymore. So I mostly use those first two techniques. It makes a ton of difference. Charlie asked me, and this is really important. Listen up, folks who are starting seeds. Charlie said, I got a ton of soil. I got it left over from last year. I don't want this stuff to go to waste. I got it in pots. I want to use it. I said, Charlie, I don't think you ought to use it. And let me tell you why. The thing that counts in good potting soil is almost inevitably coarse organic matter. The trouble with living in a climate like ours is that organic matter breaks down into finer and finer and finer particles very rapidly. And as it breaks down into finer and finer and finer particles, a lot of it just actually turns into a gas. Amazingly enough, it turns into carbon dioxide. It's just kind of tooted away as carbon dioxide as it breaks down by the soil bacteria. But what's left are these fine particles, and they just kind of, they're dense. They don't have any airspace between them. They are just like the perfect medium for soil diseases. You are going to get damping off if you use old soil mix. So, yes, unfortunately, you're going to have to buy a new bag of potting soil each year, because the old stuff will have broken down to the point that it is no longer draining well. What do you do with old potting soil? Put it in the garden. It'll be fine out there. For a lot of reasons, it'll be just fine, won't cause any problems, get diluted anyway, but it won't cause any problems in the garden. And we won't go into all the details as to why it won't. But in a pot, which does not have good drainage anyway, for a lot of reasons that have to do with the physics of how water moves, you do not want to use old potting soil. Bad, bad thing. Bad to do it. Bad to do it. Yep. So there it is. So Charlie said, thanks, though. Thanks and no thanks. Now I got to throw out all this potting soil and buy new stuff. So he's fussing at me about it. That's the way it is. But that's the truth. Old potting soil can be a bad, bad thing. And you know, it's something to think about. If you've got citrus in pots, if you've got your favorite plant in a pot, that organic matter in that pot is breaking down all the time. It gets washed out with the watering. It gets tooted away as carbon dioxide and methane or whatever else that the bacteria are releasing. It just, and the pieces get finer and finer, and it compresses, and it's terrible for your plants. That's why you have to change the potting soil in your plants periodically. Now, if it's in the yard, it doesn't work that way. Presumably. You could make it work that way, but in general, it doesn't work that way. If you want to create problems in your yard, don't put any organic matter in your yard. Don't let the leaves fall. Don't let the grasses, keep the ground absolutely bare, compacted. You're going to have problems. But in general, there's processes in the yard with all the soil creatures. They're gradually incorporating that organic matter on a constant basis. It doesn't happen in a pot. It's not even possible to really reproduce that in a pot. So you got to think about pots in an entirely different way. That's why I'm saying all that fancy goop about, oh man, we got this super fancy topsoil. It's got a potting soil. It's got bat guano. It's got kelp from Kalamazoo, it's got whatever. You just need something that drains well. You don't need the fertilizers. You just need something that holds the roots reasonably well and that drains well. There it is. 75% pine bark. That's the secret. Crystal is asking me about sheep fertilizer. Is it good? Yeah, oh, yeah, it's fine. It's really good stuff. It's not magic, but it's fine stuff. Put it on top. I don't like digging stuff in. We'll come back. We'll talk more about that. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
To Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain on my face. All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Where do I start here? Let's see. What have I missed? Did we do pretty good on understanding what was going on with damping off? If you didn't, just give me a nod. Let me know that I need to say more. But I gave three techniques. Building that soil level up gradually. Fourth technique, pretty important. Watering from the bottom. Watering from the bottom makes a ton of difference. I'd already mentioned that. So watering from the bottom, putting them in a pan of water, letting it absorb water that way. That works for a lot of reasons. That works for a lot of reasons. But just trust me, it works. Starting with the seed in a half or three-quarter filled container and then gradually filling it up as the seed grows. That makes a difference. Giving air circulation, really good air circulation. You know, I've toyed with the idea, and I can't tell you that this works. But if you have your seedlings under some kind of photovoltaic array, whatever you call that, I think some people call them lights. If you got some kind of photovoltaic array, otherwise known as lights, artificial lights inside your house, fluorescent lights, whatever, it probably helps to have a fan, a gentle fan, to move air around. You don't want to keep the plants too cool, which could happen, but it probably helps for several reasons to do that. It keeps the tops of that soil drier. You want the tops of the plants to be, you want the top of the soil to be dry, you want the bottom to be moist. Yeah. Yeah, so that's all good. And Chris, good to hear from you. Chris is reminding me to remind people. I'm going to be politer than Chris. For once, I'm going to be politer than Chris. Chris is always a very polite guy. I'm the rude guy. Does that make you feel bad, Chris? So, yes. So, Chris is whatever silliness they put on their plants last night. Yes, you're right. So, listen, if you put stuff on your plants last night that's plastic, you got to take it off or you're going to burn the plants up. Plastic touching the plants during the night, even during the night, will burn the plants because it's going to transfer heat really well from whatever it touches. That's why we use cloth first. Then you can put plastic on top of that. But during the day, take it off. It's going to be warm today. Going to warm up a lot. Call me if you got any questions about that. Call me if there are any questions about that at all, and we'll figure it out. Now, what am I missing here? So Clay in says he used perlite last year to build up around these new seedlings. And perlite can work. It can work. And I, you know, that's another fine thing to put around top. I have not found it worked quite as well as sand, but I, it wasn't a, you know, it wasn't what we call a double-blind study. It wasn't exactly like, it wasn't done in a real scientific way, but I did suggest perlite, and I think perlite can work as that top layer. I think granite probably works better, but, you know, I think perlite can work as the top layer to help prevent damping off. So those are some of the things to think about. Stopping the damping off, getting air circulation, getting your plants outside where possible makes a ton of difference. It makes a ton of difference. Building up the soil level gradually so that the plants can root in as they grow, so that you've got multiple layers of roots, all those things can make a big difference. Keith said he got his Santiago tomato seeds from Tomato Fest, and he's going to be reaching out to me to figure out what I need to do. I hope they got some Santiago seeds left over. I think my Santiago seeds are still good. I'm waiting for them to come up. We'll see. We'll see. But yeah, Santiago's a great little tomato. I really like it. And there's some others I'm trying. You know, a lot of these tomatoes that I've been really sold on, they're coming from places that have the that have humidity and warm nights similar to what we do in general. Central America, South America. I think they've been experimenting with these tomatoes for a longer period of time, and I think they're generally better for Alabama conditions all over the state. So it's fun to experiment. So I'm not going to Pennsylvania to get my tomatoes. Honestly, I don't think Pennsylvania's got much to offer us. I'm going to Central America. I'm going to South America, where tomatoes came from. I'm going to the Caribbean. And I think the tomatoes they've been meddling with and fooling with down there, they probably have a lot to teach us. Mexican tomatoes are harder, though Mexico Midget is a great one. And Veracruz, the tomatoes from the Gulf Coast of Mexico do very well because they deal with the humidity well. Some of the tomatoes from Mexico City, I find, don't do as well. And the reason they don't do as well, I suspect, is because Mexico City is a really dry climate with really cool nights, generally cool nights in summer. And they don't have a lot of the diseases that we have. They're in the mountains, Mexico City is. But on the Gulf Coast, it's a great place, even down into Mexico and certainly in Central and South America. That's one of the places where I'm going to look for my tomatoes. I think we got a lot of work to do here in the Southeast, developing seeds that work well for our gardens. We've just been, you know, everybody's got all their southern pride. We ain't done nothing to claim it. I mean, we aren't working to develop our own seeds. We aren't working to develop our own concepts for gardening. That's what we need to be doing. Not hand-me-down stuff from Europe. Not hand-me-down stuff from Boston and Michigan. They got it figured out. I mean, they're thinking about it. They've been thinking about it. They're making it work for them. We just got to make it work for us. So we got to look around. We got to think about it. We got to pull in the right seeds. Get it started. Have I heard anything about Five Rivers being closed and sold to developers? I don't think that's true. I would not believe anything I read on Facebook. The first rule of Facebook is don't believe it, right? That's the first rule. Then, if you like, investigate it. But the first, you can start at a bare minimum, at the base. The base is, don't believe it. Somebody made it up. Nobody's going to stop them from making something up and putting it on there. There it is. Is it too late for spring cabbage? Michael's asking me. No. It's not. I think it's probably a good time. Get a short season cabbage. Don't get a long season cabbage. Jersey, early Jersey, Wakefield would be a good one. Get it started inside. Get it outside as soon as possible. But I think it's about the right time, Michael. I'd certainly try it. You want it to mature in cooler temperatures. I think in general cabbage does better in fall because you want it to mature in cool temperatures, if not, well, by Gulf Coast standards, cold temperatures. So you really want it to mature in November and December. They're probably your best cabbages. But you can do all right. So if it's a 70-day cabbage, you get it started now. You got mid-February. Let's just pretend you got mid-February is your first month. Mid-March. So, you know, by the 1st of April, you could have a pretty good cabbage, right? And it still will be cool nights. You might actually even have, it might be really cool nights. You could end up with some really good cabbage. But get it started now. Get it started now on the Gulf Coast. If you're farther north, you got a little longer. You got a little longer farther north. If you're up even around Monroe County, you know, I think you'd probably want to target having your cabbage ready to harvest about mid-April would be great. If you're up around Birmingham, mid to late April would be fine. Would be fine. There you go. One way to think about it. Is it too late for spring cabbage? Just a short season one. Don't do any long season ones. Early Jersey Wakefield's good. Anything that's about 70 days, there are some hybrids that produce even more quickly. I've seen them out there. I've meddled with them a little bit. 55 days, all that's fine. You're going to be calling me about the 1st of March asking me, oh, I got bugs on my plants. Yeah, you're going to start seeing the bugs sometime in March. We'll talk about what to do then. There's some ways to deal with that. That's pretty good. Remind me about 1st of March to talk about that. But, yeah, good time to start spring cabbage. You know, I think there's some advantages to having cabbage out of your yard. It's the grocery store cabbage is okay. It really is okay. But it is not, it ain't what you get out of your yard when it's grown really well. Particularly if it matures in cooler night temperatures. What you get out of your yard can be really delicious. Got a lot of depth of flavor. I mean, it's not slap you in your face flavor. It's just good, rich, deep flavor. Makes great coleslaw. Almost, it's so good, you just don't even want to cook it. Great for coleslaw, that stuff out of your garden. I think it's just about time to do that. Listen to this. We got one last break, and then we got time for you to call, so give us a call. 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. I need to say that because Carol's calling from Huntsville. More or less. How are you this morning?
I'm just peachy cold, though. Really cold.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. So, get a little. You might want to not use your speaker. You might want to use your microphone on your phone. Get a little closer to it.
Okay.
Your speakerphone. Yeah. Can you hear me okay? Can you hear okay?
Is it better?
Yeah, that's better. Thank you.
So, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it.
Yes.
I have a soil pH up here of 7.6, and I've taken it over twice over the last 5 years, and it's not moved. And so I've been, when I moved into this area, That's the first thing I did. And then I started planting some trees, which pretty much all have died. I had first started off with a Nootka, a Camassipris, you know, weeping. And I know that's a really Alaskan tree, but what the hey.
Yeah.
I was going to try it. And then I planted in the front, same pH, I planted a rising sun redbud, and I knew that the bark was thin, and if we had a warm January, the sap would run and bust it open, and it sure did. And then we got this ice storm, and it ripped off a long branch, and it was the most beautiful tree, but I had to take that down because half the vascular system was gone. And then in the backyard, I planted an Empress of China dogwood, and now I have planted, and also in the back, I planted a male ginkgo biloba. And in the front yard, I finally broke down and bought an American serviceberry. All of the, you know, the ginkgo is and the American serviceberry are the only two left. I have drip hose on them. They're in plant beds. I'm not real super generous about, you know, I don't water every day. But the both trees that are left, the serviceberry and the ginkgo, have these tiny baby leaves. They will not grow any bigger. The tree doesn't grow. It's just not thriving. And I'm just wondering, is that a symptom of something biological in the soil that's killing all these trees? Because I'm losing time after 5 years of getting a decent tree in my yard.
Yeah. One of the great glories of Alabama are all the limestone soils. And you are on some limestone soil, and it sounds like this limestone soil must be on a slope, right? Is it on a slope somewhere?
Actually not. Actually, it's just a tiny, gentle slope in the back. It's not really. It used to be farmland, so the calcium is really high. Yeah.
Is it down towards the bottom of a slope then?
No, not in the front. Or no, the back is a little bit, you know, but it's like it's
so,
on drip hose.
So this is interesting. So there is a story, and I haven't dealt with these soils a lot, but there are prairie soils in Alabama. And one of my good friends, Dwayne Estes, has made the case that one of the reasons people were attracted to Huntsville in the first place was because of the prairies with their grasslands. And mm-hmm. these prairie soils don't grow trees well. They grow grasses really well. And
my ornamental grasses grow well, very well.
And so one of the problems with these limestone soils have throughout in many parts of the state is they have huge shrink swell capacity. And that means if you've got houses in your neighborhood and they're having foundation work done on them, it's because those soils are shrinking and swelling all the time. And a lot of trees are not adapted to a high pH, but even more importantly, when you get that shrink swell, it tears the roots of the trees apart because as the soil, you see what I'm saying? As the soil dries out and shrinks, it tears the roots apart. And so that can be a big problem in a lot of soils. The solution to any prairie soil, to getting virtually most everything to grow there, is getting topsoil. And adding topsoil is mostly a matter of adding organic matter. And so you want to add as much organic matter when you plant those trees as possible. There are some great trees for prairie soils. And I'd love to go through them with you. We will just have to figure out where we're going to find them. Red buds are pretty good on prairie soils. They actually do generally very good. You happen to get a very finicky selection that was some nursery in Ohio came up with. But red buds can do really good, and they're great transitional trees. One thing to think about with red buds is they don't live a long time.
No, they don't.
So that's okay. That's fine. They'll be pretty. They'll be pretty where you are for 25 years, and then they'll transition to something else. But don't get a finicky selection. Just get straight red bud. Dogwoods are terrible for those kinds of soils. Don't even just forget about the dogwoods. They're not going to work at all. The ginkgos should do okay, but they need organic matter. So you're going to need to borrow organic matter from your neighbors. And you're going to have to call me back because we're going to run out of time. But you're going to have to borrow organic matter. And you know how you borrow organic matter from your neighbors? You go down to somebody who's got a lot of trees. They put all their bags on the street. And you just smile and you pick those bags up and you take them home and you put them on your soil. And they'll break down and turn into incredible topsoil.
What about pine
mulching straw? Around
that's
those?
That's what I've been going down to a friend's house and raking up all this pine straw. And I put that on
and the area. And that helps too. That helps too. Leaves will help probably even more. They actually produce more volume. But just keep doing that. That's going to make a ton of difference. And now what we're going to have to do, because we're going to flat run out of time, and it's such a great question because I'd love to talk about it for the whole state, is to think about the kinds of trees that can grow really well on those limestone soils. Now, here's another thing I want to, but before we do that, I want to remind you, that was a prairie. The grasses and the wildflowers did great. Roses are going to do wonderfully well. There are a lot of plants that are going to do really well on that calcium and on that limestone that they wouldn't do as well for other people in the state. So it's kind of fun to think about, ooh, what can I really do well here to take advantage of this in my yard? We'll put some trees in there, but let's also think about how do I learn from what was originally here, and how do I make the use of it? And now Charlie's told me 1 minute, and you have started this great discussion. You know what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to call back.
Okay.
Can you do that?
I will, because this is a really painful subject for me right now.
Yeah, we got to figure this one out. And it'll be good for a lot of people in the state because there's, you know, St. Stephen's got a lot of limestone. There's a lot of limestone around Birmingham. It's in the Black Belt. It's up around Huntsville. And we don't know what to do with it sometimes because we don't think about limestone in Alabama, but it is one of the glories of the state, these limestone soils, and something really fun to work with. So let's think about what can really work well there. I'm going to be making some notes. I'm going to be looking for some sources for you. So you call me back, and let's
Should
figure
I send
it out
my
next
soil
week.
Sample so you can see what it is?
I know
you
what
know
it
the
is.
Results?
I don't even need to see it. I can tell you.
Okay.
I know. I understand it perfectly. So
okay,
we'll deal with it when you call back.
Looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
All right.
Me and my best friend Lillian and her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played, waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red.